You can't go! All the plants are gonna die!
I'm gonna take a bath.
Bad dates.
I'll alert the media.
Boys, keep off the moors.
It's evil! Don't touch it!
The name's Plissken.
No war! Hang on!
Welcome to Vintage Video, where we're rewatching the 80s so you don't have to. We'll be reviewing every major film release of the 1980s in chronological order, overanalyzing what you've seen and spoiling what you haven't. I'm Patrick O'Reilly.
I'm Jesse Bayless.
And I'm Richard Wells.
And today we're discussing Taps, released December 25th, 1981. It was written by Daryl Ponickson and Robert Mark Kamen, based on an adaptation from James Lineberger of a novel by Devery Freeman, directed by Harold Becker, and released by 20th Century Fox. In 1929, Devery Freeman's novel, Father Sky, was published. The subsequent film adaptation initially kept the book's title, but was later switched to Taps, which in some home releases has been retitled as Taps with asterisks between the letters. That's how the cover box looked at our Blockbuster.
MASH?
Yeah, exactly. It's supposed to imply a spiritual connection to MASH, which the kids actually watch within the film, despite Taps not being an acronym. Taps, of course, being the name of a piece of military music played at dusk and funerals. To prepare for the lead role, actor Timothy Hutton read many novels, including Melville's Billy Budd and a biography of General Patton, which appears in the film. He engaged in several games of chess to build a professional rapport with actor George C. Scott. Overall, around 2,000 young actors were auditioned to fill the ranks of Bunker Hill Academy, and basically everyone we've seen in the age range was at least brought in for consideration. The lucky selected cast were all given 4 weeks of military training and official haircuts and uniforms. Some specific cast members were given additional specialized training in rifle drills and horse riding. It was originally set up at Columbia, but when they put the project in turnaround, it migrated to 20th Century Fox. The production floated from location to location after Culver Military Academy in Indiana rejected the film because of its ending.
We used to go to Culver Military Academy.
Is that where you did your fencing?
We did.
Yeah?
Yeah, we'd go every year for a tournament there.
Nice.
Usually landed on the same weekend as homecoming. So we'd go there, get all bruised up, put on our fancy dresses, and drive back home to go to a dance.
For the black and blue ball? Hargrave Military School in Virginia rejected the film for the same reason and because it would require significant construction on site. Riverside Military Academy in Georgia came close and approved the construction, but would have required so much work that it was vetoed by the producers.
Then why was it even in contention?
Because they didn't know how expensive it would be until they got the numbers back. Fishburne Military School was turned down because the gate was too small to fit a tank through. And ultimately, Valley Forge Academy in Pennsylvania met with everyone's approval, and a satisfactory gate was built custom for the film and dismantled after production wrapped. We open with a chorus of voices singing Onward Christian Soldiers, which we've heard many, many times in 1980 and 1981, most recently last week in Warren Beatty's Reds. Picture starts in a church on the campus of Bunker Hill Military Academy. Toward the end of the church service, George C. Scott as Brigadier General Bache takes the stage and introduces a reading from the Book of Remembrance. What?
I can't look at you.
No, whenever I start talking about church stuff, you like look at me. Like, let's hear what word he's going to fuck up this time.
Yeah. Well, and I would say that this is more of a chapel than a church.
Fine. Holy Christ.
What's the difference, Richard?
Well, I would...
You can fit a chapel on a church.
No. Yeah. Yeah. I understood that reference. Because a church is generally open to the public and has a congregation, where this is a private building that's just for the school.
Fine. A boy stands in the center aisle of the church with a bugle and plays the titular song. General Bache recites the names of graduates from this military academy who have died in battle.
Okay, I didn't quite understand it. I think these are these recent deaths?
No, they're just people who have gone to the school over its 120-year history who have died in battles.
Okay, but it didn't mean that these guys have died between the last service and this service?
No. This is anyone who's ever died in battle from this particular school.
Yeah. That seems like either a really short list or an incomplete
list. Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Like only 12 people died?
Well, that's why I thought maybe it's just the most recent people who have died since last week, you know?
Right.
It's just like, oh, maybe you were born in, you know, 1932, but you just died peacefully in your sleep last night.
No, because a lot of these people had died in like World War II.
Yeah, but there's not a lot of repeat battles mm-hmm. in the list that he's reading from. So,
they're just randomly, or not very many people have died from this academy?
I guess. I mean, what percentage of soldiers die in any given battle that came from this particular academy?
I don't know.
On their way back to the barracks, Timothy Hutton as Cadet Captain Brian Moreland and Sean Penn as Cadet Captain Alex Dwyer make up joke names and list them back and forth as fictional additions to the remembrance list. They pass Tom Cruise as Cadet Captain David Sean in the hall, who asks them when their next D&D practice is. When they smile, unfazed, he flips them the bird with an angry look. Now, this kind of sets it up like he's the jock bully character and they're like the nerds.
Yeah.
But that's not the case at all.
No, no.
It also sets them up like they don't respect the military tradition when...
They absolutely...
They're totally obsessed with it. Yeah, it's very strange. Clearing the upstairs hall, Cadet Moreland hears a television blaring from a room with some of the younger kids and pushes inside. They kick the TV into a box under a bed to hide it, and Moreland pretends he didn't see anything while performing a brief inspection of their bunks. They are relieved not to have been punished. Back in the hall, Moreland encounters Cadet J.C. Pierce, played by an almost unrecognizably baby-faced Giancarlo Esposito. Pierce tells Moreland that a cadet nicknamed Shovel has been sneaking massive amounts of food into the academy. When he spots the overweight cadet, he races down the hall after him when Pierce is suddenly flattened by crashing into a behemoth cadet nicknamed Hulk. Moreland ducks into his own room where his roommate Dwyer is tossing darts at a board with his eyes closed. One of the youngins, Charlie, walks in offering to take Moreland's shoes for shining.
I also like that none of these darts stick to the board.
Yeah, they hit it and fall.
Yeah, like, it's like he's not throwing them with enough force for them to even stick into the, well, I guess, cork? What are dartboards made of?
Sure. He's just not committed to it. We cut to that night where General Baish hosts a dinner with just Moreland and outgoing Cadet Major John Cooper as Baish regales them with his romanticized war stories. They seem enchanted.
In battle, sir, how do you keep from being scared?
You don't. My God, was I scared. Oh, I must have lost about 20 pounds, all of it brown.
Baish talks about the night 45 years ago that he was promoted to Cadet Major by General Black. After their meal together, they retire to share brandies in the study, and Baish officially promotes Moreland to Cadet Major. Back in his room, Dwyer, Sean, and West are all drooling over Moreland's new oak leaf insignia. Sean invites Cadet Major Moreland into the hall in honor of the occasion, and then marches down a row of his own red berets who set their rifles to twirling. Moreland salutes the men, and Sean dismisses them. Back in his own study, we see General Baish pour himself a glass of water and sit behind his desk to take a pill. Foreshadowing. We cut to the next day as a military parade does laps around the academy's track. Baish salutes each group as they pass. Baish gives a commencement speech to the crowd, but today marks a beginning and an end.
An end to nearly a century and a half of tradition, and an end to the heart of us. I have been informed that Bunker Hill Academy is to be closed. All of its buildings torn down, nothing to be left but memories.
The cadets react to this announcement as though this is the first time they're hearing it. They will have one last year here together. After the ceremony, Moreland goes to visit Baish in his office and listens to the man complain about what's been done to the academy against his wishes. Baish is an old man who spent his entire life in uniform. He's disgusted by civilians and terrified to soon be among their ranks. We cut to the showers where some of the younger cadets complain that they will never be upperclassmen here. Even as they're complaining, they're getting shoved out of the shower by older cadets, Sean and Dwyer.
I think he like shoves one of the kids to the next shower stall and he goes, "Thank you, sir."
Yeah.
Yeah, he does.
Thanks, sir.
Apparently, Moreland thinks that somehow Baish will reverse the official decision, and Sean somehow agrees based on nothing we've seen. I don't know how they think he's going to do that.
Yeah, well, I think he's right.
That makes two of you.
In his office later, we see Baish plug his service weapon into a holster on his belt. Later, he stands in a hall outside the Bunker Hill dance and shakes hands with people as they walk in.
See, I thought he was getting this, putting on his uniform.
He was going to go crazy and kill himself.
Oh, yeah. I thought it was like he was just getting himself into uniform to do a final hanging of himself or something.
A truckload of townies have set up shop across the street from the academy to heckle everyone as they arrive. A couple of the cadets get particularly annoyed by it, and when they start throwing cans at the gates, Cadet Pierce asks them to disperse. Suddenly, crowds are lining up on both sides of the argument, and one of the smaller kids, Charlie, runs to get the general. A fight breaks out, and in trying to break it up, General Baish is suddenly jumped by a townie who pulls his gun from its holster and fires it into the chest of another townie, killing him near instantly. Bizarrely, the kid who pulled the trigger is not apprehended or even pointed out or blamed.
Yeah.
They just, like, let him go, and he just wanders off. He doesn't even seem guilty about it.
Yeah, and his prints would be on that gun.
For sure.
But also, the issue was here that...
there was a gun bullet in the chamber, which there shouldn't have been.
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody just acts like Bache shot the kid on purpose, even though he's the one who brought a loaded gun to a fucking dance. So it is kind of his fault. Bache even seems to blame himself.
It was around in the chamber. I forgot.
You killed him.
I'm sorry.
For a guy that's seen as much war as Bache claims to, he sure seems completely in shock over what's just happened. We skip forward a bit as Bache is collected by the police from his residence on the base and put into a squad car. Moreland tries to assure him that things will be okay. Later still, radio man Bug is enlisted by the boys to break into the police radio channels to figure out what's going on outside the school. They learn here that Bache seems to be suffering a heart attack and is being hospitalized for treatment. In Bache's absence, his cadet major Moreland is technically left in charge of the school. In the middle of the night, Charlie speaks with his parents on the phone and says he'd like to stay here in spite of all that's happened.
Are there really no other adults at the school aside from him?
I think in the military hierarchy, he would be the next one up. It does seem weird that it's just a general and cadets and that's it.
Well, I feel that there is a civilian administration staff, and we get this sense in the next scene when those people are taking inventory.
Right.
And I feel like they're the ones who are probably maintaining like the offices on campus. Like if there was like a toilet broken, you would have to go to, you wouldn't go to the general and say, hey, the toilets are broken. You'd have to go to somebody in an administration office.
And even though they work on the academy grounds, they're not militarily ranked.
Right.
The next day, outgoing Cadet Major Cooper drives off and wishes Moreland luck. Representatives of the group sent to disassemble the campus start to tally up the contents of the armory. They seem vaguely terrified by the excess of weapons and ammo on campus. They're here to remove all the live weapons in the wake of last night's tragedy. Moreland walks in on this process and assures them that the death was an accident and they need these weapons for drills, but they really don't. They could just use batons like everybody else does.
Well, but that's the thing. It's like, you know, your color guard and stuff like that. They use like wooden rifles. Like, can't you just use fake weapons?
You're basically a flags team. You don't need real guns for this.
I mean, maybe these guys, I mean, these kids do later seem to know how to shoot and stuff.
Right,
so
I
suspect that they actually probably do things like target practice and...
Maybe. We don't see any of it in the film. Moreland learns that Bache is in intensive care. He asks who will run the school for summer session, and it sounds like the school might shut down early, all things considered. Later, we see the kids watching Star Trek in the rec room when Charlie bursts in and switches the TV to the news. The townie has officially died from his injuries. Most of the cadets are learning from this broadcast that the weapons are being confiscated, and Bache sounds at death's door. The owners of Bunker Hill Academy have officially pulled the plug on this last year of operation, and the academy is due to be shut down effective immediately. Moreland takes a stand in front of the television and announces that they are officially in charge of this place, and Dwyer wants to know what that means to the cadets, and we hard cut to a pair of military trucks backing up to a loading dock at Montgomery's warehouse. They tell the manager here that they're picking up food supplies for the time it will take to close the school. The man seems confused why they're here to pick up, since usually he delivers these rations, but Dwyer invites him to call the academy, and the guy says he trusts they know what they're talking about. Presumably they had someone prepared to take that call back at the academy, though.
Right, right.
They quickly load the trucks, and we cut back to the academy as a police car is allowed through the front gate. The car collects an inspector on the way to the armory, but the entire warehouse is now empty, and they are all perplexed. They walk all the way up to the back wall of the building when they're followed in by Moreland, and they ask him where everything went. He informs them that his cadets have secured the weapons and ammo elsewhere.
What do you mean secured? You mean you stole them?
No, sir. We confiscated them.
Moreland presents a list of demands to be met before the ammunition stock will be returned. First, he demands a meeting with General Bache. As one of the cops tries to handcuff Moreland, they notice a row of armed red berets lining the catwalk above them. They have loaded guns pointed down at the adults, and Moreland is given space to finish his list of demands.
Number two. I want a commission to look into the selling of this academy to real estate interests. Number three, I want a meeting between my officers, myself, and the Board of Trustees to discuss alternatives to the closing of this academy.
The adults are allowed to leave to deliver Moreland's demands to the authorities. On their way back from the supply run, one of the military trucks stalls at a red light. Cadet Dwyer is unable to get the engine started again, and it's blocking the second truck back. Another crowd of townies start to surround the broken-down vehicle and heckle them to avenge their fallen friend. Impatient with the mechanical difficulties, Cadet Sean fires a rifle in the air to scare away the townies, and all the cadets return to the base in the functional truck and leave the other one in the street. They will only have half the supplies they counted on.
See, I don't know, understand, like, I was thinking, like, why don't you just put the truck in neutral and have the other truck push it? That truck is strong enough
right,
to
for sure.
push that other truck.
Yeah. A police car skids up to block their path, but they crash right into it, and the cop gets out to open fire into the retreating military truck.
Yeah,
it's like, these are children. What are you doing?
Well, I guess he doesn't know that, but
it doesn't
still.
Matter. It's still any
yeah,
person.
Yeah, exactly.
He's driving away from you. I mean, I know you're a cop, but Jesus. When the truck returns to the base, everyone celebrates the delivery despite the absence of the second vehicle. Dwyer vocalizes his disapproval for Sean's approach. He doesn't think firing the gun was necessary, but when all the facts are laid out, Moreland seems to agree with the actions Sean took. All the adults on campus have been sequestered onto a bus, and they're being driven out the gate.
We're gonna let them go? Well, yeah, Hulk, we're soldiers. At least we're supposed to be. We're not gonna take hostages.
Moreland orders a meeting of the officers in the administration building in 15 minutes. He reminds his officers, Pierce, Dwyer, Sean, West, and Harris, that this kind of infighting in front of the cadets will lose them respect and loyalty. The plan from here is to communicate their demands to the outside world clearly and to assure everyone they don't pose a real risk to civilians. Moreland hears police arriving outside the gate and calls his cadets to attention. Obviously, they're responding to the use of an automatic weapon in the middle of town, so they've sent 10 or 12 squad cars.
Boys, this is Lieutenant Hanson of the state police. Now, before things get out of hand, put down your weapons and open the gates.
Do you hear me?
We have conditions first. Let's have an answer on those.
You have illegally seized private property. Under the provisions of the state penal code, you have committed grand larceny. You have also threatened the life of a federal officer.
Nobody's life was threatened. Now, what about those demands?
I thought I recognized the cop lecturing them through this megaphone, and it finally clicked when he used it to obscure most of his face with only his eyes visible, because this is Wilson. Neighbor from Home Improvement.
Yeah, I saw his name in the credits, and when he appeared and he just covers his face with the microphone, I was like, oh my God, come on.
It's like they did it on purpose, but it's way before Home Improvement, because on that show, his face was always mostly obscured for anyone unfamiliar. None of the kids puts down a weapon, though, and they ignore a countdown from the police. When the time runs out, one of the younger cadets jumps over a wall of sandbags, hoping to capitalize on this last chance to escape the situation.
Don't shoot me!
Hold your fire! Hold your fire!
Hold your fire! Don't shoot me!
The kid scales the gate and jumps down into the arms of state police outside the wall. This seems to end the confrontation, and we cut right to that night as Lieutenant Hanson is being interviewed on television about today's events. Hanson suggests that some of these boys are being kept at Bunker Hill against their will. He's basing this on the student that did escape at the last second, but even as they hear it on television, the kids all think it's a bunch of BS. That night, West and Dwyer are on gate duty, watching the police, and West theorizes that Baish's heart attack was made up to deny them access to the general. Moreland spends the night sitting behind Baish's desk. In the morning, he supervises inspection, and then they do a quick head count of the cadets. The inspection is interrupted with an important phone call from the authorities. Moreland takes this to mean that they will be discussing his demands. Turns out the delegation at the gate is not here to discuss demands.
It's a delegation of parents.
Parents?
Six of them. The man in charge is Master Sergeant Kevin Moreland.
Moreland's own father is here to speak with him. Cadet Major Moreland agrees to meet with the parent delegation. He seems less than excited to speak with his father, and we learn that his mother passed away when he was very young. She died at an army hospital with some kind of kidney problem.
So I'm sitting there, and my father comes out of the room and tells me that she's dead. He led me to this little chapel they had there in the hospital. He sat me down. He told me I could cry for 15 minutes. He gave me 15 minutes to cry, and after that, I wasn't supposed to cry again. So he left me alone in the chapel. And came back. He came back 15 minutes later.
Jesus, what'd you do?
Well, I did what I was told. I cried for 15 minutes.
Dwyer is shaken by the story. Sean comes in and reminds him it's time to meet with the parents. Moreland's father addresses his son on behalf of the other parents and asks for reassurances that all the children are here willingly. Some of the parents can't believe their children will get wrapped up in this.
Lady, if my son can be involved in it, your son can be involved in it. Let's not get holier than thou.
Let us see our children and hear it from them.
Yes.
Mr. Moreland pulls his son aside for a private conversation and offers him a few ways out. When Cadet Major Moreland rejects his father's plan, Mr. Moreland reminds him how easily the police outside could take this academy. Major Moreland claims they have a code of honor and they will follow it to their deaths, and his father finds this laughable. Moreland credits the base for his resilience in the face of these confrontations, and Mr. Moreland explains that General Baish is a reject and a moron, and that's why he got left at this crumbling military academy for decades. When the talks fall apart, Major Moreland orders Sean to escort the parents off the property, and Mr. Moreland slaps his son hard across the face. Later that day, Major Moreland asks all the cadets in formation if they would like to leave. He wants to know that no one's here against their will. He invites anyone with second thoughts to take a step forward, but nobody moves. The cadets are marched back to the bunks. We see Cadet Shovel wandering the halls in search of grenades. He asks Sean for one and gets only an annoyed glance in response. When he asks another cadet, the kid tosses him one right away.
Here you go. Thanks.
Oh, and Shovel? Don't need it.
Cute.
Moreland checks in with the younger cadets, Charlie and Derek. They're in charge of monitoring radio broadcasts from outside the gate, but they have no news to share. In their room that night, Moreland seems very pleased with how things are going, but Dwyer thinks he's crazy. Just because all the cadets are staying loyal to the Major doesn't mean any of them are doing it for the right reasons. He suspects they will accuse Moreland of having brainwashed them. In the middle of the night, Sean's men are watching the gate when a convoy of heavier-duty vehicles approach. The cadets start taking their positions with weapons aimed at the police. West starts to panic as dozens and dozens of military vehicles circle the camp. A van slowly passes the gate, broadcasting recordings of parents pleading with their children to come to their senses. Charlie's dad hops on the mic, and he listens, but he doesn't move. Behind a brick wall, a cadet is standing guard when West appears from the shadows. The cadet reports his orders.
Shoot anything that comes over, under, or around the wall, sir.
On whose orders?
Captain Sean, sir.
West brings his concerns to Moreland that the men outside the base may decide to escalate the situation. He doesn't like that their sentries have orders to shoot on sight, but Moreland thinks his concerns are overblown.
Nobody here wants to get killed. They know we're right, and they're not going to come in here shooting.
The next morning, at attendance, 11 cadets have gone AWOL overnight. 2 from Dwyer's D Troop, 4 from Pierce's Alpha Company, 5 from West's Charlie Company, but none from Sean's Bravo Company.
Bravo Company, all present accounted for, sir.
Very well.
11 goddamn scouts.
Hold it down.
Moreland is called to a conversation with Colonel Kirby, as played by Ronnie Cox. Moreland suggests that removing this property to make room for condos is a complete waste. Kirby asks if Moreland realizes that a school full of kids are no match for the U.S. military. He explains to Moreland that the town thinks they're terrorists because they technically are. He suspects many more are on the verge of defecting. Moreland calls all the cadets to attention and offers them a free pass on escaping the academy safely to assure there are no traitors in his ranks. Finally, West takes the opportunity to commit to leaving, and Shovel follows him out, as do dozens more, even men from Sean's company this time.
Take off that beret.
West leads 30 to 40 cadets out the main gate just as a Bell helicopter flies low over their ranks.
Yeah, I don't know what that was about.
Yeah, it seemed like they would be more concerned about that, but I guess not. That night, Sean tells him he shouldn't have given them the option to leave, but Moreland has obviously shrunken their forces to his most devout followers. It's less people to track and provide for, but a weakened front for sure. Sean advises Moreland to take a nap, and it reads a lot like a scheme so he can make decisions without him, but nothing comes of that implication. The next morning, the water to the academy has been shut off. There's still tanks on site to draw from, but they won't last forever.
I don't know why this wasn't done
the first day.
Immediately, yeah. Power, water, and then start, you know, probably driving them crazy. Don't play the sounds of their mother calling to them. You got to play something annoying.
Yeah. We cut to some of the kids watching MASH in the rec room, and Dwyer is sitting in a corner looking depressed. Sean comes in to switch the TV to the news, but Dwyer intercepts and improvises a report on the Bunker Hill situation. He puts an invisible microphone in the faces of random cadets, and Sean is not amused by the demonstration. Moreland walks in on it and is similarly disappointed, but Dwyer goes right back into the joke and tries to interview the Major, who he refers to as Blood and Guts Moreland, a reference to the nickname of General Patton, whose biography can be spotted among the books on the desk at the administration building, and who was famously played, to an Oscar win, by actor George C. Scott portraying General Baish in this film, and after whom the tanks have been named, also, that approach the gate later. Moreland doesn't play along with the game and orders the cadets to bed. Dwyer reminds his fellow cadets that Sean and Moreland will punish them all severely for disobeying anything, and they only care about themselves.
All right, we've had enough!
You don't want to save this school for posterity. You want to wear it like your own private cocoon, just you and Beige. Snug as two bugs, queer for each other.
Moreland is officially pushed over the line and drags Dwyer into the hall, bashing out posts in the stair rail with his back and wrestling violently back and forth. Rather than stepping in to stop the fight, Sean holds the cadets back to let Moreland pummel Dwyer into the ground, until the lights cut out and they realize they're being denied yet another utility. Lights from outside are blasted through the window and it's clear an operation is underway. Sean orders everyone to their battle stations. Dwyer has to limp back to his room after the fight. Outside, a tank comes rolling down the street and up to the gate as the kids take their places behind sandbag piles, and the encounter apparently ends there. Moreland returns to his room that night and buries his head in his hands at his desk. The next morning, Pierce and some cadets from his company attempt to operate the academy generator to restore electricity to the school, but Pierce has just barely finished refueling when he flips the switch and the gas fumes around him are ignited and he's fully engulfed in fire.
Well, it's not just that. The kid filling the tank is pouring the gas, like, all over the place.
Yeah,
like,
That's Pierce.
Okay, yeah. Well, regardless, like, it's not just fumes. Like, he's literally spilling gas all
over. On himself, over the generator, yeah. He screams and backs away as the other cadets smother the flames with a blanket, and we see Pierce being loaded into an ambulance outside the gate. Colonel Kirby relays the obvious to Moreland.
You know you're responsible for that boy.
It was an accident.
And, of course, Moreland refuses responsibility. Beige apologized when a townie took his gun and shot another townie, but Moreland can't even apologize for the danger he's put all these kids in for no apparent reason. Kirby offers Moreland another chance to give up. The governor's close to ordering a military assault to take back the school, and Kirby assures Moreland that neither of them will enjoy that.
Sure, I know what they want us to do. They want us to be good little boys now so we can fight some war for them in the future. Some war they'll decide on. But we'd rather fight our own war right now.
That's like a really pretty powerful line.
Right. But that's also the whole fucking point of the army. Like, did he just notice what an army is? Or has he had a problem with that the whole time? Because up until now, he makes it seem like he's been all about that army life. Mm-hmm. And he's like, by the way, the whole way that the army works, now I don't like it. Moreland claims to be a soldier, but Kirby disagrees.
A soldier? No, goddammit, I'm a soldier. With the career goal of all soldiers, I want to stay alive in situations where it ain't all that easy to do. But you, my friend, you're a death lover.
He accuses Moreland of having a romanticized view of death in battle.
Dying is only one thing. Bad. Don't find that out. Please.
Moreland decides to drop some of their demands in exchange for just one of them. A conversation with Beige. If Beige orders them to stand down, they will. And at this point, I feel like Beige would order them to stand down.
Yeah. Of course he would.
General Beige died last night at 6 o'clock.
Moreland takes some time reading Kirby's face to see if it's true and then rescinds any offer of surrender. They hold a military funeral for their fallen general, and of course taps is played. Moreland eulogizes the man holding a sword that Beige was gifted by General MacArthur. That night, Derek asks Charlie why they don't play tapes from home anymore. Derek misses the voices of his parents. He admits he's scared that they're all going to die, but Charlie assures him that won't happen. Derek begs Charlie for permission to surrender right now. He suddenly climbs over the sandbags and runs for the gate, but when he tosses his weapon to the ground, it goes off, and bullets rip through the gate and ricochet off the forces outside, who return fire suspecting an attack. Charlie chases after him to help his friend, but as Derek climbs the gate, Charlie behind him is struck by the return fire and falls to the ground. He appears quite instantly dead also. Seems like bullets are very, very fatal in this universe.
Yeah. I feel like the people outside should have had fairly strict orders not to fire on the children. Like, regardless of the fact that these guys have weapons and they're a threat, like, even if one or two of these kids are shooting, they should just get behind cover and wait it out. Like, there's no reason that they should be firing back.
Yeah. I don't know. I do feel like if there's an active shooter, that they do have some responsibility to stop that.
Yes and no. Like, but the thing is that they know that the person shooting is shooting at them, not at other
civilians.
Yeah. You know, so like nobody else is in danger. You guys can just hide behind a brick wall and wait this out rather than firing back immediately.
Yeah.
Because they aren't, it's not like they shot specifically at somebody that they knew, because nobody was actually firing at them. It was an accident.
We see Charlie's hand twitch for a half second before he passes away in the beam of a light from the tank outside. The light is shut off, and we hard cut to another ambulance collecting another cadet, but this time they won't be headed to a hospital. The EMTs have to remove Moreland's hand from Charlie's to collect the dead boy. Kirby tries to impress on the remaining cadets that this whole situation needs to end now before any more of them are needlessly killed. Sean tells Kirby to communicate through the officers, not directly with his men, and Kirby explains that at dawn, they will be taking back the academy, with the full military force at their disposal. Sean clearly cannot wait to meet this challenge, and uses Charlie's death to strengthen the resolve of his cadets.
At dawn, throw down your weapons and run to the nearest National Guardsman. Now we will do our best to protect you and to see that you get out safely, like they did Charlie. The bastards killed him!
The next morning, nobody can find Moreland until Dwyer hears Bache's voice coming from his office. Moreland is screening old films of Bache's as a form of advice on their situation. Dwyer turns off the projector, and Moreland muses on all the progress Charlie had made here as a student. He knows dawn is near, and a decision has to be made. He talks about his very real love for Bache and what the man represented here, but ultimately Moreland comes to the realization that this action he has led here was indefensible, and Dwyer tries to spread the blame.
I've done a terrible thing here.
You weren't alone. We were all in it together.
It was my command and I was in charge.
Moreland has to admit that a dead little boy can't be put in the context of honor or military strength or loyalty. A dead kid is just a dead kid. Dwyer begs Moreland to just declare victory and bring an end to their occupation of the base, but Moreland knows that nobody will mistake a surrender for victory. Just before dawn, Moreland marches down the main road along the bunks and orders the cadets to stand down. They're officially giving in to Colonel Kirby and his forces. The cadets all line up behind him and approach the main gate as a large group. Kirby seems cautious but pleased by the development. Everybody joins Moreland's formation except for one, Sean, who points his rifle at the window looking down on the main gate and fires on Colonel Kirby, knocking the man back. Now, when we see him in the crosshairs, it's like right on his throat.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when he pulls the trigger, it hits him in the shoulder or something.
Yeah.
Moreland's cadets scatter at the sound of gunfire. Both Moreland and Kirby order their men to hold their fire, but Sean obviously keeps going, because he's not about honor, he's just excited to murder people. He takes up an M60 machine gun and starts pounding down on the gate with it. It finally occurs to Moreland where the barrage is coming from, and he rushes to Sean's room to stop him.
And even the military forces are firing up at the window.
Yeah, just at this one room now. Kirby's choppers drop smoke bombs on the campus, which is probably helping as much as it's hurting. A pair of cadets are nearly crushed by the incoming tank, and when it empties onto the campus, one of the soldiers within is instantly shot dead. Moreland and Dwyer get to Sean's door and order him to cease fire.
Sean!
It's beautiful, man! Beautiful!
Moreland dive tackles Sean to the ground, but it's too late. The return fire from the gate has perforated the room, and Sean and Moreland are both killed. By the time Kirby and his men reach the room, they find Dwyer sobbing over Moreland, and we cut to Dwyer carrying the major out of the school through the smoke. The operation is over. The school has been taken back. We cut to a graduation ceremony, and upon inserts of Moreland and Bache, we realize that this is actually the commencement ceremony from the start of the film. The camera holds for a moment on the faces of each casualty of this ill-advised operation, and we cut to black for the credits to scroll. The end. Taps.
I did not know what this movie was about.
Yeah.
I've seen the cover. And I thought, oh, okay, it's like a military movie.
Yeah.
I did not expect it to be like a Lord of the Flies, like Apocalypse Now kind of movie at all.
Yeah, it's very Lord of the Flies at a military academy.
Yeah. Meets not Toy Soldiers, the other one.
Toy Story.
No. The one where there's a bunch of military academy kids and the place gets taken over.
Toy Soldiers.
Is it Toy Soldiers?
Yeah.
Then what's the one with the actual toys?
Are you talking about...
Toys?
No.
Are you talking about the Pixar short with the soldier?
Okay, so Toy Soldiers is the one I was thinking of. Mm-hmm. What's the name of the one where they have, like, action figures that come alive?
Small Soldiers.
I always get those two titles mixed up.
Yeah. No, it is a lot like that one. But in that one, the children are warranted in their decision. Mm-hmm. What seems the hardest... to buy for me now, and it makes sense in Lord of the Flies because it's like there is no authority that's right there that's able to do anything about it. They don't even know if anyone's ever going to find them while they're alive on this island. In this movie, I don't know why all the kids don't leave.
Well, because I think that they've literally been indoctrinated to glorify, you know, this stance that they're taking.
And, but they're being told by their own hierarchy that they've glorified to stand down and leave, and they refuse to do it. Like, why are they choosing this one rebellious major?
No, but he is the last ranking officer left in their midst.
But Colonel outranks Major.
But they aren't actually part of the military.
Yeah, they're not part of the school. They have no vested interest in the school.
So the kids have their own ranking system within this academy, which has nothing to do with the U.S. military.
But I feel like if you're going to have a military academy at all, that a big part of what you should be drilling into these kids' heads is respect for an actual military hierarchy.
Yeah, their ranking member of their school is telling them to do this. Moreland is telling them to do this.
I don't know. I mean, it seems crazy to me that Moreland would be put in this position if he's that psychotic that he's like, you know, I'm gonna be seditious and I'm just gonna like start a confederacy here in the middle of a city.
I think he is. I think he is that crazy because I think that this has come to replace his sense of family.
Yeah.
In his life, and so the shutting down of the school is him losing everything.
Yeah.
And you know, and is it Baish? How do you say
it? Baish. Yeah.
And Baish not being there is also, you know, him losing that father figure. So this is all he has left. And so he wants to preserve this. And he's not looking to kill anyone. He wants to just have a conversation. And his way of having a conversation, because he's like, look, you guys aren't going to give us the time of day. It's going to be too late by the time you even talk to us. So I'm going to do this just to get you to the table to talk to them. These idiots on the outside didn't even give him a chance to be heard. They're just like, cool, we're going to take over now.
I do feel like it's also a reflection of what Mr. Moreland was talking about, that Baish is kind of an idiot and that he didn't see the problems like of putting this kid in charge of everybody directly beneath him, because it's like, no, this kid has no respect for the military like you do. Like, this guy's talking about, you know, famous American battlefields that he's fought on and his respect for MacArthur and for General Black and all these people who are ranked military officials who he respects. And, you know, he's reading this list of all these people who died in battle that are patriots by his estimation. And these kids don't give a shit about that. All they care about is what happens on this campus.
Well, and Ronnie Cox kind of says it in a line of like, when he's like, what are they teaching you in here?
Right.
Like, this isn't a military code. You're living by your own rule.
Right.
And, It's hard because, you know, you're literally taking kids, like, they're all kids, but then there are kids that are there. You know, there are 12-year-old kids that are there that you are putting in danger and haven't even had the amount of training or have had the time to get the sense of honor or respect for the school that you have.
Right. I mean, essentially, like, it's funny that Tom Cruise calls them out like, oh, when is D&D practice tonight? Because what they're doing is like military LARPing. Like, that's what they're doing here. They have like their own like fake king that they, you know, pledge their loyalty to, but none of it's real. Like, and they're trying to make it real. And then when they realize that it's not what they thought it was, then it's too late.
Yeah. It, at its core, it is just a school. They talk about, like, you know, Dwyer is like, I carried you through science, through math.
Right.
It is just a really fancy school that also has extracurricular activities of military training, military roles, salutes, chain of command. But once you finish here, you go to an actual military academy, the previous. Yeah.
But I would think that these people would be like a leg up toward like an officer's school. Like that they wouldn't be going into the front lines. This isn't like general infantry.
No, exactly. No.
They even say at a certain point that these guys are going to West Point and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It just looks good on a transcript
right. That
you went to this school.
But it just seems like it confuses me that it would not be an important focus of the military academy that, you don't become traitors to the country of the United States. It's like, that feels like that should be an early lesson on the plan.
Well, they are the ones who feel betrayed.
I was going to say, I don't think that they see their position as treacherous. Yeah. I think that they see their position as this place is good, and it is part of the military, and it is part of some tradition that they want to uphold. So I don't think that they see their position as trying to preserve this as bad.
Yeah, I just feel like the reason it's getting closed in the first place is because it's losing money compared to condos. And the first lesson of military school should be, your job is to protect the money of rich people. Because that's what the military does in the United States.
Yeah.
It's just insane to me that these kids would so, like, all of them would agree simultaneously to take up arms against the city that they live in defense of, it's like, yeah, we are at a school that's losing money and it has to close. Like, you wouldn't do that for anything.
Well, I feel like they thought that they would declare that they were taking the school. These are their demands, and their demands aren't really super intense. It's not like they were asking for sovereignty, their own sovereign nation or anything.
They're asking for the school to continue running at a loss?
Well, they're asking that they wanted an investigation into options to keeping the school open. They never said that the school must stay open. They want a say in what's happening to the school, but they also want to talk to Baish. And had that happened, had Baish been able to speak to them, Baish would have told them, he would have told them to stand down.
No, sure. I think he would have.
I mean, this sort of stems from Baish's fault in the first place for giving them hope that he was going to fight it.
Mm-hmm.
Because he is a member of the actual military, and he...
And for him to out loud express that kind of an dissent, unrealistic...
Yeah, mm-hmm. not cool. Like, it's his own fault for giving them that hope when he shouldn't have.
Yeah.
Because as students, they have no... You know, as the general, he has recourse to fight. He has contacts. He can do things. He can hire a lawyer, you know, and help the situation. These students don't have any other options.
I think what would have helped me accept this would be for there to be a little bit more of an argument in favor of what the kids are doing. Like, for example, if there was some kind of a fraud or a financial conspiracy behind the closing and selling of the academy, that like, oh, there's legitimately something that was, you know, dirty.
Falsified.
Yeah. Something underhanded that happened that's forcing the closure, and the kids know about it and they want it to be investigated, and the city was ignoring it. And,
right.
But the fact of the matter is that the land is privately owned. The people who own it are allowed to do what they want, because if you privately own something, you're allowed to sell it. And that's what they did. And it just makes the kids only bad guys, and it makes them all terrible decision makers, because none of them can stand up to the U.S. military, which is obviously going to be used to defuse the situation.
Right. Well, and that's part of the point of the movie, is that they're kids. Like, they don't know what they're getting into. They don't realize how easily they can be crushed by an actual trained military.
But I went to public school and I knew that. Like, how do they not know this at a military academy? I mean, I guess the point is just that they're being taught that they could, change the world.
And a lot of them did know it. That's why they left.
Eventually, like, yeah. I just can't believe that so many people rallied behind Moreland and were like, yeah, that's a great idea. That will work out to our advantage. Let's do it. Like, I guess they all have the same daddy issues that Moreland has. And they were all like, this guy respects me for doing what he says, so I'm just going to keep doing it.
Well, I think a lot of them might have had similar feelings to Moreland in terms of this place being incredibly meaningful in their lives, because it was graduation day essentially when they found this out. They were going into summer semester, so a lot of the kids had already left. My understanding is these are the ones that were still there. These are the ones that didn't have anywhere to go over the summer.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I guess it's supposed to feel along the same lines of like an Animal House situation, where like a fraternity is getting closed against their will. And so it's like, but this is our thing. Like, this is literally all I care about, because nobody likes me anywhere else.
And they were all going to have the opportunity. Baish even says they're all going to have the opportunity to find other military schools to go to. Like, this one school closing does not mean all schools are closing.
Right. We're not going to stop military.
Yeah, and especially Moreland's dad being who he is, I'm sure would find his son another military school to attend.
Yeah. What do we think? Thumbs?
I actually really liked it. I don't know why. I think it was very much not what I was expecting from the movie. So there was a lot of unexpected turns for me in terms of what these kids were doing and what they stood for. I was, you know, kind of annoyed at the first 20 minutes. I'm like, and I think I literally asked you, I'm like,
Does anything actually happen in this movie? Because I was like, it's about to.
We spent the first 20 minutes just kind of marching in circles, and it was very boring.
It was the scene before the dance that she was like, is something going to happen? I was like, yeah.
Something happens.
Hang up for a second.
Yeah, so I think that skewed my opinion. I was just like, oh, shit, some stuff really did happen. Yeah.
Plot point one is about to hit right now.
Yeah, and I liked the dynamic of, you know, each of these kids kind of having to make their own choices and coming from a different perspective and that sort of thing. So I'm going to give it a thumbs up.
I definitely would have been that first kid that first night that was like, don't shoot me, don't shoot me, and dove over the gate. I would have been like, yeah, no, this is crazy. This is totally crazy.
The horror.
Yeah.
The horror. It's a thumbs up from me. I'll probably not watch it again. I can't think of any too many scenarios where I would go, you want to watch Taps?
Fair enough.
Because it is upsetting to watch kids get killed and kids.
Yeah.
Like, it's the same reason. I feel really honestly about the same way about Lord of the Flies. It's interesting.
Or Battle Royale.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I've watched those movies once. And you obviously read the book, Lord of the Flies, in school. But it's like, I have no desire to experience those things again.
Yeah.
Because it's like just, it is literally
a bummer for sure.
A tragedy.
Yeah.
But I would give it a thumbs up as far as just a well-made film with good characters and, you know, you just look at the debate that we're having about it.
Yeah.
There's a lot to unpack. So I don't think that it's a bad movie by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. I am also going to give it a thumbs up, even though I really can't identify with any of the characters in the movie.
You can hate the military and still have it be a good movie.
It's not even about approving or disapproving of the military. There's not a single character in this movie, other than, like I said, the kid who jumps over the fence the first night, that I feel like, oh, they made a single decision I would make in their situation.
Yeah.
Like, starting with being at a military academy in the first place.
I don't think a lot of these kids chose that.
They definitely didn't choose them. I'm lucky that I had a dad that cared about me. You're going to military school. I didn't have, like, Keanu Reeves' dad.
It's the opposite of what your father would make you do.
Was it Ted or Bill that was getting sent to military school?
Bill.
Bill, okay.
Oh, no, Ted. Yeah, Military Academy.
Right.
You may have heard me say Disneyland, but I specifically said military school.
Is that from Bill and Ted?
That's from The Simpsons.
Oh, okay.
That's when Bart is going to be sent to military school, but then Lisa decides to go in as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I think they even mention a boy that didn't want to be there and was crying every night and then turned around. So I think, like, there's definitely kids that would be like you there.
Yeah, no, for sure. We're the kids that are getting fresh meat chanted to us while we sleep.
It's like, where is it? I'm starving.
Oh my God, please. What are we thinking Letterboxd for this one?
So I put it at number 39 out of 179. It is below Cannonball Run and above The Nesting.
Richard.
I have it at 46. Big surprise here because it's actually below a horror film, Halloween 2.
Okay.
And then above Sharky's Machine.
Okay. I have it at 130, which is just under Force 5 and just above Nobody's Perfect. That's where I put it.
It's a much better made movie than those.
Yeah, that's why it's above Nobody's Perfect. Our director here was Harold Becker. We saw his work previously for our minisode review of The Black Marble the previous year. Later, he directs Vision Quest, a couple Madonna videos, Sea of Love, Malice, not to be confused with Absence of Malice, though both films star Joseph Sommer, Mercury Rising, and Domestic Disturbance. The writer here was Daryl Ponickson. He previously wrote the novel adapted into The Last Detail and later screenplays for Vision Quest, School Ties, and most recently Last Flag Flying, a sort of sequel to The Last Detail. The other writer was Robert Mark Kamen, This is his first screenplay. Later, he wrote The Karate Kid and has creator credits on that whole series of films and television. He has a screenplay credit on Lethal Weapon 3, which I thought were all Shane Black scripts, but apparently he only wrote the first one and the story for Lethal Weapon 2, and then the rest are just character credits. Kamen also wrote The Fifth Element, Kiss of the Dragon, The Transporter, and all three Takens. The adaptation here was done by James Lineberger, just this. The novel was from Devery Freeman. He has credits dating back to the 30s, uncredited writing on Ziegfeld Follies in 45, and in 54 and 55, he wrote a couple installments of the Francis the Talking Mule series, specifically Francis Joins the Wax and Francis in the Military, and 11 episodes of the Thin Man series on his way to his final IMDb writing credit, this film. The music here came from Maurice Jarre, or Jari, who wrote the scores to Lawrence of Arabia, Dr. Zhivago, Ghost, and Witness. We've heard his work in The Black Marble, The American Success Company, The Last Flight of Noah's Ark, Resurrection, Lion of the Desert, and Choo Choo and the Philly Flash. The cinematographer here was Owen Roisman. He previously lit The French Connection, Elaine May's The Heartbreak Kid, The Exorcist, the original Taking of Pelham 123, The Stepford Wives, 3 Days of the Condor, Network, and so far on the show, The Black Marble, True Confessions, and most recently For Absence of Malice, and we just lost him in January of this year. The editor here was Maury Weintraub. He has previously cut Funny Girl, Cactus Flower, Funny Lady, and so far on the show The Black Marble, The Jazz Singer, and later Vision Quest. George C. Scott was General Harlan Bache. We've had him so far as John Russell in The Changeling and Barney Kane in The Formula last year. He's also General Patton in Patton, General Turgidson in Dr. Strangelove, and Burt Gordon in The Hustler. Later, he's John Rainbird in Firestarter, Kinderman in Exorcist 3, and the voice of McLeach in Rescuers Down Under. He was awarded an Oscar for his Patton role, but famously refused to accept it because acting isn't a contest. Timothy Hutton played Brian Moreland. He was Conrad in Ordinary People the previous year, for which he took home an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. Later, he's Christopher Boyce in The Falcon and the Snowman. He's Colonel Kent in The General's Daughter, Hugh Crane in the first season of The Haunting of Hill House, Nathan Ford in Leverage, Season 4, Episode 17, The Radio Job. And every other episode of that show.
Yeah. Like, why specifically that
He's the main character of that show. He reunited with Giancarlo Esposito in episodes of Nero Wolf and Leverage. He also reunited with Ronnie Cox in a D.B. Cooper-centric Leverage episode, with Cox as the Cooper stand-in. He reunited with Sean Penn in 1985's The Falcon and the Snowman, and he is exactly one day older than Sean Penn. Ronnie Cox played Colonel Kirby. We've previously covered his first film performance in Deliverance for a Patreon-exclusive episode. He's back later as Lieutenant Bogomil in Beverly Hills Cop 1 and 2, Cohagen in Total Recall, but he's probably best known as Dick Jones in RoboCop. Sean Penn was Alex Dwyer. This is Penn's first film. He exploded to popularity after playing Jeff Spicoli in Fast Times at Ridgemont High the following year. He reunites with Cruise for Risky Business and later appears in Carlito's Way, Dead Man Walking, for which he got his first Oscar nomination. He was also nominated for Best Actor in 2000 for Sweet and Low Down and 2002 for I Am Sam before winning in 2004 for Mystic River and again 5 years later for 2009's Milk. More recently, he is very politically active and usually only shows up playing himself in stuff, with the recent notable exception of voicing Terrence the Giant Red Bird in Angry Birds, who barely says anything.
Was that really Sean Penn?
He does the voice of that bird, yeah.
I did not know that.
In Paul Thomas Anderson's Licorice Pizza, he played Jack Holden, who is not so loosely based on William Holden. He was cast in this role based on his turn in an off-Broadway play called Heartland. Tom Cruise played David Sean. We saw him last in his first film as Billy in Endless Love. Later, his career skyrockets via roles in The Outsiders, Risky Business, Top Gun, Rain Man, A Few Good Men, and in 1996, he appeared in the first Mission Impossible film in the role of Ethan Hunt, a character he is still actively playing nearly 30 years later. My favorite turns from him are probably Magnolia or Vanilla Sky. He has 4 Oscar nominations for Born on the 4th of July, Jerry Maguire, Magnolia, and Top Gun Maverick as a producer, but has yet to win.
You didn't like him as Les Grossman?
No, he was good in that, too.
In Tropic Thunder?
Yeah. Who was based, I think, on Harvey Weinstein and Joel Silver and a number of other people. Evan Handler played Edward West. This was his film debut. I really only know him as Charlie Runkle, the husband of Pamela Adlon on Showtime's Californication. He's very funny on that show. He's also Harry in Sex and the City, the TV show and the films. John P. Navin Jr. played Derek Mellett. Who's that? Derek Mellett. He shows up as Cousin Dale in National Lampoon's Vacation and half of the couple at the drive-in in Joe Dante's Explorers. Oh, that's the kid.
Yeah, it's the Derek, kid. Yeah, Derek
the one
and Charlie.
The one that's trying to run away when Charlie gets shot. But for some reason, the credit that rang a bell for me on his IMDb page was Boy in the Cheers pilot. Basically, the cold open of the first episode starts with a 14-year-old kid coming into Cheers and trying to order a beer from Sam with a fake ID. He's technically the second actor we see in the whole series, and the first scene is just him and Ted dancing together. At the time, I was thinking it would have been amazing if they got this kid to come back for the series finale to play the same character, but now well old enough to drink, to illustrate how long Cheers had been on the air.
Oh my God, that would have been amazing.
Billy Van Zandt played Bug. He's the half-brother of Sopranos actor Steven Van Zandt. He was also married for some time to Adrienne Barbeau. We've seen him so far in a custom review of Jaws 2, and his most recent acting credit was as Groucho Marx on The Marvelous Miss Maisel. Giancarlo Esposito was J.C. Pierce. According to IMDb, this is our second time seeing Esposito after he appeared as an extra in The Changeling, uncredited last season. So this is his second movie with George C. Scott, if that is to be believed. Later, he shows up in The Cotton Club, Desperately Seeking Susan, Maximum Overdrive, Do the Right Thing, Malcolm X, The Usual Suspects, and Homicide: Life on the Streets, on his way to his most celebrated role as Gus Fring on Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. Rusty Jacobs played Rusty. He played the younger version of James Woods' Max in Once Upon a Time in America. Jess Osuna played Dean Ferris. Before this, he was Frank in A New Leaf, The Major in 3 Days of the Condor, and Ackerman in Kramer vs. Kramer. Earl Hindman played Lieutenant Hansen. He was Deputy Red in The Parallax View, Mr. Brown in The Taking of Pelham 123, but if you don't recognize him, you probably don't recognize him for playing Neighbor Wilson on Home Improvement. James Handy played Sheriff. This was his first film. He's Milton Briggs in Arachnophobia, Wooly in The Rocketeer, and Exterminator in Jumanji. We'll see him again next season as Kevin Donaghy in The Verdict. And the last credit I have here is for Gary McCleary, who played a townie, specifically the one who gets shot. He appeared previously with Sean Penn in TV movie The Killing of Randy Webster. Those are all the credits I have for this one. I think that's everything for Taps and for 1981. We're finishing our second season of the show with this episode. Obviously, we'll come back with 1981 year-end wrap-up, but this is our last official film and our last Letterboxd ranking of the year. If you have any thoughts you'd like to share, you can find all our socials at linktree.com/vintagevideopod. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you'll join us next time when we'll be discussing 1981 in its entirety. We leave you now with a sneak peek at the next season's opening clip montage. Please enjoy.
We have to put that together before you edit this.
Crush your enemies.
They drew first blood, not me.
See them driven before you.
Oh, my user.
And they hear the lamentation of the women.
But I pity the fool.
Glitter in the dark near the ten house gate.
Phone home.
They're here.
Oh, real light sleeper, child.